Central Time. I'm Rob Farage. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, we check in on U.S.-Russian relations following a meeting this morning between President Biden and Russian President Vladimir Putin over potential threats to Ukraine. First, starting this week, migrants seeking to enter the U.S. from Mexico will need to stay there until their immigration hearings. If that sounds familiar, it should. That was a policy known as Remain in Mexico, first implemented in 2019 under former President Trump. But then President Biden ended it on his first day in office. A couple of red states later sued, and a federal court wound up ordering the policy to be reinstated. The White House appealed to the Supreme Court, but justices didn't overturn that ruling. Last week, the Biden administration announced it reached a deal with Mexico on what the reinstated program would look like. It's similar to the Trump-era plan, not exactly the same. You can join in at 800-642-1234. How do you feel about the Remain in Mexico policy being back in effect? Is the U.S. better or worse off with it in place? How do you feel about the Biden administration's handling of immigration issues overall? What do you think he's doing right or wrong? Do you want Congress to tackle the issue in a big way? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas at WPR.org. Rick Sue is a professor of law at the University of North Carolina School of Law. He teaches and writes in the immigration and federalism. His research focuses on the intersection between cities and immigration. Rick, welcome back to the show.
Yeah, it's a pleasure to be back.
Can you talk about the significance of this Remain in Mexico policy? The formal name under the Trump administration was the Migrant Protection Protocols. What does it mean that it's coming back into place?
So what it means is that essentially individuals that are coming to this country to seek asylum, instead of being able to await their hearing within the United States, that they would be sent back to Mexico, which from which they came, and they would remain there until their hearing date actually comes up. So as a result, what we have produced under the old iteration of this program was tens of thousands of individuals essentially waiting at the border, the ports of entries, for their immigration hearing to actually come up before they can actually get their claim heard.
Before this policy, this Remain in Mexico policy was in place, and during this brief period where it was not in place between the Trump administration and now the Biden administration having to restore it, what happened to that Central American would-be migrant filing for asylum? Where would they go in that period while they're waiting for their claim to be processed?
Yeah, it's important to realize that the Remain in Mexico program was relatively novel when it came out and didn't really last for all that long. So the standard procedure before that and during the interim was that individuals that applied for asylum would either be kept in detention or the administration would grant them parole of some sort to let them into the country while they await their hearing. And part of this is because the immigration system is incredibly backlogged. So oftentimes it takes a while for these hearings to actually be available. So if the original idea was that they would remain in detention and be heard relatively soon, the current system as a setup is not suited for that. So as a result, prior administrations often granted parole if they didn't see them as a flight risk or a danger to the community.
Can you talk about conditions for these Central American migrants while remaining in Mexico?
Yeah, so that's been one of the biggest central concerns with all these individuals essentially returned to Mexico. So right now, when the program was in place, there was about 70,000 migrants that were returned, and they largely concentrated in the border towns around the port of entries. And there were a lot of concerns about their sort of housing condition, and a lot of them set up sort of makeshift tents, camps that were set up. And there were a lot of concerns, and in fact, many documented cases of violent assaults against these particular individuals. Also concerns that cartels were getting involved with regard to kidnapping and certain extortions targeting these individuals themselves. It's important to note that the people that are forced to return to Mexico aren't Mexicans. They're not Mexican right. nationals. They're essentially individuals that arrive through Mexico, but coming from another country. So as a result, the concern was that they were particularly susceptible to the conditions in Mexico in which they were temporarily staying.
Now, the court ordered the Biden administration to go back to this policy. The Biden administration negotiated with Mexico for some revisions, in part with those safety concerns in mind. Do you see significant differences here?
There are some differences. Whether they're significant, I think, waits to be seen. So in terms of the humanitarian concerns, which of course was the primary reason that the Biden administration wanted to get rid of the Remain in Mexico program, they did say that they would do a rescreening for individuals who are at risk of persecution if returned to Mexico, and that individuals that were at high risk would not be subject to the program. So they would either remain in detention in the United States or be paroled in. So we'll see how they actually apply that particular exception. Though it should be noted that persecution is actually a very narrow ground. So a sort of random violence or extortion for cartels may not necessarily satisfy that. So even this particular protection, though addressing some of the humanitarian concerns, doesn't address all the safety concerns that would apply to these individuals if they were returned. There's also exemptions now based on age, disability, sexual identity, medical conditions. So depending on how broadly the administration construes those, it may actually send less individuals back than the Trump administration. But again, we'll have to see with regard to the actual implementation.
We're talking to Rick Hsu from the University of North Carolina School of Law, looking at the return of the Remain in Mexico policy for asylum seekers, mostly from Central America, south of Mexico, trying to come to the United States, and wider issues of immigration under the Biden administration. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Let's bring on a caller now. Michael is with us in Waterford. Michael, hi.
Yeah, hi. Afternoon, folks. A comment and a question, if I may, is, as we all know, there is a labor shortage in this country, and especially a state like Wisconsin, where agricultural is begging to have more workers. And I remember the Elder Bush floated an idea where we'd bring in more immigrants, document them, temporary work visas to help fill that shortage, and especially at a time like right now. So why is it so difficult at this point to enact a program like that? Is it purely political? Is that why the difficulty, where the difficulty is coming from? Because I've seen so many openings apparently begging for employees, many of whom could come from Central Latin American countries and fill that need. Why is this such a difficult process to enact?
Michael, thanks for the call. Rick, another issue that's come up a lot with immigration, especially as Michael says, with many businesses saying they can't find enough workers.
Yeah, so it's interesting, actually, a lot of other countries, for example, Germany, has actually been expanding recently immigration in light of these shortages with regard to workers. And there's a lot of reports that says that, you know, given shortages all around many industrialized countries, that they should be looking to expanding as well. This is not even on the radar right now, right? So it's not even being discussed. And maybe it will change, you know, going into the future. And a lot of it is because immigration politics has become quite political, to say the least, but in some ways toxic. So all this would require some action by Congress, and Congress has been really reluctant to act on this. I think with the failure of the Gang of Eight, sort of the last effort for a bipartisan compromise, I think the sides have really solidified here. And even the Biden administration is feeling pressure on the immigration issue. So I'm not sure that the American public or Congress has really changed around with regard to immigration, and not just with regard to humanitarian, which we're discussing previously, but even with economic migration. So we'll see how that goes and whether or not this labor issue will start reorienting how we think about the immigration issue as a whole.
Michael, thanks for the call at 800-642-1234. We'll go to Jim now in Cedarburg. Jim, hi.
Hey, thank you, Rob. Great show as always.
Thanks.
Yeah, to your guest, you kind of hit on my question, which is, why does it seem like it's left to the president to make immigration policy when Congress holds the purse strings, and every 4 years we get a new president? And we really like to have some consistency, especially employers. Could you elaborate, please? I'm kind of confused.
Jim, thanks for the call. And I think a lot of people share Jim's confusion. And we've talked about this before, Rick. President Obama or Trump or Biden does what they can with an executive order, hopes they can get it through the courts. But as our caller is saying, Congress has a lot, potentially a lot of authority to resolve these questions in a more consistent way.
Yeah, let's be honest. These questions and the bigger issues is something that Congress needs to address, right? They set the immigration laws. And before, we did address them, you know, at a relatively regular basis, right? We had a big comprehensive immigration reform in 1986, another in 1996. But other than the U.S. Patriot Act and the Real ID Act, we haven't really looked at the whole immigration as a whole since 1996. And part of it is just this congressional paralysis on this particular issue and the way that has become polarized. It wasn't as polarized before, right? There were a time in which actually it was sort of straddling the political parties in strange ways, employment interests in the Republican Party, sort of civil rights, non-discrimination sort of interests in the Democratic Party, but that kind of broke down. Well, to be fair, there has always been a lot of powers and authority given to the president with regard to immigration, partly is with regard to national security and true emergencies. But what we're seeing now is essentially the use of those powers to effectuate immigration policy. And what we're seeing now is this tremendous whiplash. And I would say it probably isn't limited to immigration. We have a lot of congressional paralysis on a lot of different issues. So increasingly, presidents have just been using executive orders to do a lot of policy work. And as a result, right, this just changes anytime an administration changes. It's certainly not the way to do it, but the solution really has to come from Congress.
Thanks for that call. We're looking at the return of former President Trump's Remain in Mexico asylum policy. Rick Sue is with us, law professor at the University of North Carolina. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Courts ordered the Biden administration to reinstate that practice, requiring mostly Central American asylum seekers to stay in Mexico while their claims go through the system. What do you think of that idea? Do you think that's the right way to approach this or not? What questions do you have about it? Do you have wider thoughts or questions about immigration under the Biden administration? You could join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. We're talking about the Biden administration's approach to immigration and the reinstatement of former President Trump's Remain in Mexico policy for asylum seekers. That requires migrants to wait in Mexico until their U.S. immigration hearings. The practice is being re-implemented in phases starting this week. Rick Sue stays with us, professor of law at the University of North Carolina School of Law. He focuses on cities and immigration, and you can join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts on the Remain in Mexico policy or your thoughts or questions about the Biden administration and immigration more generally. 800-642-1234 is the number to call. Let's go back to your calls now. Steve is with us in La Crosse. Steve, hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I have a comment and a question. My comment is that I think this is an appalling decision, that there's ample evidence that people who are being held in Mexico are in inhumane conditions and just vulnerable to trafficking of all kinds. My question is this even illegal, I mean, even legal under international asylum laws? Thank you.
Interesting question, Rick.
Yeah, so there is a concern about whether it's legal. So under our obligation to the protocol that we signed with regard to the status of refugees, we're not supposed to return someone to the frontier of a country in which there's a risk that they may be persecuted. So I had mentioned earlier that we are now doing a screening, or at least the administration wants to do a screening to determine whether that would be the case and not apply the policies to individuals that may be at risk. But there is a concern whether the screening itself or the type of procedure we give is actually adequate to meet our international obligations. And there are many who believe that is not the case. It's also important to note that the judge itself that actually is forcing the Biden administration to re-implement this program didn't actually say, or at least the Supreme Court, when they upheld it, didn't actually say that the Biden administration couldn't do it. They just said that the reasoning that was given was arbitrary and capricious. And the reasoning that was given was, in large part, these humanitarian concerns. I do think in some ways that this is a the Biden administration has reissued a memo trying to explain why they do it. We'll see what the courts do with that. But it is a little bit of an extraordinary move, I think, by the courts here a little bit. In terms of the kind of concessions and sort of deference that they gave to the Trump administration. Whereas here, it seems like not the same kind of traditional deference has been granted with regard to the Biden administration. even though they have offered a substantial explanation for why they want to get rid of this program.
Thanks, Steve, for that call at 800-642-1234. Rick, what are we seeing when it comes to trends and the numbers of people coming up from Central America seeking asylum in the U.S.? I know there were big increases last year in particular, I think, driven by crime in a few Central American countries, natural disasters, climate change, and more. What's happening lately?
Yeah, so the numbers are up. It's really unclear right now with regard to how many are coming to seek asylum, but encounters by the CBP and removals have been up. This is also note that a lot of people, even before the Remain in Mexico program, were being removed under Title 42, which is a CDC sort of order with regards to COVID risk. So there's actually been an uptick, but also a lot of removals that have been happening during this time. But you're absolutely right. We're seeing new trends, not only Central America, but Venezuela, Brazil, and increasingly recently from Haiti. So a lot of this program is going to be impacting those individuals and not just the Central American migrants that arrived under the previous iteration of this policy.
I got an email from Janet who asks, why aren't immigration and refugee applications handled in U.S. embassies of particular countries, presumably the country of origin? Why does somebody have to come up and seek asylum at the border, I guess, instead of at an embassy in their home country?
Yeah, so this is, there's two reasons here. Now, to be, the Obama administration did propose something like this, of essentially being able to apply for asylum in the country in which you are. The two complications that arise are, number one, the international obligations that we signed that solidified the asylum process only applies to individuals that actually leave their country. So technically, if you do not leave your country, you're not considered a refugee and you can't apply for asylum. You're not under these international obligations. So that's number one. There's plenty of what they call internally displaced individuals, right, who are not living in their particular communities. Those don't even count in the numbers with regard to what we count for refugees. The second is the thorny sort of issue of asylum applicants within a particular country and whether or not that country is, let's say, happy to do so, right? A lot of countries don't want their citizens to leave, and certainly not to leave because of complaints about their particular country. So operating that in a embassy within that particular country often raises very sensitive foreign affairs issues. And even with this Remain in Mexico program being renegotiated, we have to note that it was renegotiated with Mexico, which is a sovereign country. So there is a lot of sort of State Department foreign affairs concerns here. So it's not clear why the Obama administration didn't pursue that proposal, but I wouldn't be surprised that some of these diplomatic concerns is part of the issue.
Big picture, when it comes to Biden and immigration, you've got criticism from some of his fellow Democrats saying he hasn't done enough to turn back former President Trump's policies. On the Republican side, accusations of, you see the phrase, open borders from time to time. Where do you see the Biden administration falling overall on what they've done on immigration over, you know, since last year, January?
Yeah, I think they're stuck in a very difficult position. I do think on the much broader level, being headed up by Vice President Kamala Harris, is this effort to say, look, if this is really being driven by instability in certain countries or safety concerns or climate change concerns, we really need a sort of broader international program or something to be able to try to stabilize those countries or essentially give the opportunity to individuals so they don't have to leave, right? Not everyone wants to leave, but that is a long-term goal. And in the short term, that gets completely derailed by, again, right, the fact that the administration can't really control how many people is coming to seek asylum. We don't have that much detention capacity. We don't have that much capacity, and partly because Congress hasn't allocated enough money to actually do all these hearings and these adjudications. So I think the Biden administration is really trying to, as they've been trying to, take a moderate stance and do what they can, but they're essentially going to be upsetting everyone in this particular situation. Not to mention the role of the courts here, blocking almost every single effort that they've tried to implement some sort of policy with regard to immigration.
I said last year, January. I meant, of course, this year, January. We're not in 2022 quite yet. Rick, the big question here, something we touched on earlier, the idea that Congress could, maybe should, you say, do something big on immigration. In a way, though, it seems like it's getting further and further away from that being a possibility. There aren't even negotiations about negotiating that, it seems like.
Yeah, I think that's definitely right. And I think part of it, we'll see what happens coming up with the DACA program. And the reason I say that is because the DACA program is, right, this is with regard to Dreamers, individuals who arrived at a very young age, is very politically popular. And in some ways, even among Republicans, right? So you would see that this program, or at least some sort of congressional action on this, would be plausible. It was held up for a long time because people were using the Dreamers as political football to try to extract more enforcement or whatever it is on all various sides. DACA is coming up too. There's a court case on it. It's probably going to head to the Supreme Court at some point, whether or not DACA is legal. So that may then really sort of up the pressure on Congress to deal with a program that's really popular. And maybe at that point, they may be willing to address a much bigger immigration reform once the DACA issue forces it.
Timing-wise, we've got a midterm election coming up this year. We don't know when that Supreme Court case. Do you see maybe 2023 after that midterm election and that court decision being a go moment for immigration in Congress?
We're going to see. And I think both sides are in some ways posturing to see the sort of outlook of the American public on immigration. Right now, Biden feels a lot of the pressure because his polling on immigration is not great, right? It's probably his sort of one of his weak points. And as a result, I believe he's being really cautious on this point. And I feel like both sides are kind of waiting it out to see, you know, what is the position to take on this. So I suspect that we're not going to get any congressional action until they figure out exactly what the tone or the mood of the American public is and how they can sort of deploy that into a platform of some sort. But unfortunately, I feel like right now immigration, everyone's unhappy with it, but no one has a really clear idea of what they want to do with it. And until that gets settled, I don't think Congress is going to do anything.
Rick, thanks for joining us again.
Thank you.
That's Rick Sue, professor at the University of North Carolina School of Law, talking with him about the reinstatement of former President Trump's Remain in Mexico asylum policy and other big immigration issues facing the U.S. Coming up after the news, President Biden met with Russian President Vladimir Putin this morning over tensions with Ukraine. We'll get the latest. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we talk about some of the coolest and strangest food traditions on the planet with the co-author of a new Global Guide to Eating. Now, President Biden met virtually this morning with Russian President Vladimir Putin to try and prevent a feared invasion of Ukraine. Russia stationed tens of thousands of troops near the Ukrainian border, but says it has no intention to invade. Biden threatened economic sanctions in seeking a diplomatic solution to the tensions with Russia, firmly opposed to Ukraine joining NATO. We're learning more about the conversation between the two world leaders and how Russia-Ukraine relations affect the United States. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Are you worried about the risk of escalation on the Russian-Ukrainian border? Are you glad to see Biden and Putin sitting down to talk virtually? What do you think of the Biden administration's approach to Russia? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 with your thoughts or your questions for our guest. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. Yoshiko Herrera is a political science professor and former director of the Center for Russia, East Europe, and Central Asia at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. Yoshiko, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you so much.
Well, as I mentioned, Russia built up a large number of troops near the Ukrainian border. Have we seen this kind of thing before, or is this something new?
Well, this is actually a little bit of a repeat of the spring. The troop buildup started in March, April of this year, and it was a bit alarming then. And so my sense is that Russia is sending a signal with this additional deployments at this time.
I know U.S. intelligence agencies are trying to figure out if the signal here is an impending invasion or just a threat. I guess nobody knows that except maybe Vladimir Putin. But what do we look at to try to assess whether this is a legitimate risk of an invasion here?
Well, I think it's a legitimately tense situation, and it's a situation that could escalate and be dangerous. But I don't think it's very likely that Russia is planning an invasion. And I think that is the case for a couple of reasons. First, if Russia did want to invade, why have this sort of public troop buildup? Why take out the element of surprise and sort of wave your arms and say, hey, look, we're doing something here at the border? So that's the first thing, is I just don't think a territorial territory is the goal. And second, I don't think there's very much evidence at all that Russia is interested in taking over Ukraine, occupying it permanently, dealing with a hostile Ukrainian population if they were to invade. I think that there's a lot of evidence that Russia would like to end the conflict in eastern Ukraine because it's deeply unpopular. It's sort of a stalemate. So the troop buildup is alarming, but I don't think it would make sense, very much sense, for Russia to invade, although, of course, as you say, we don't know Putin's true motives.
Looking at this through the eyes of Russian leadership and Vladimir Putin, from what we've seen from them in recent years, what do they want in Ukraine? What is their interest in their neighbor?
So I think this is where I think a lot of the interest is. Russia's made very clear what it wants is it wants Ukraine to not be part of NATO. And that is something that the Biden administration or no American administration is willing to say publicly. The Russians constantly point to a 2008 document that's from the U.S. that said Ukraine will be part of NATO. Now, people on the U.S. side downplay that, but Russia is very, very concerned about Ukraine joining NATO. They're concerned about arms sales to Ukraine, about further military involvement between the U.S. and Ukraine. So I think it's very clear that Russia doesn't want Ukraine in NATO, and it's very clear that the U.S. is not willing to formally say that won't happen or to take back the 2008 declaration. So that is a big problem, because Russia, I think, is sending a signal saying, hey, we really care about this. We really mean it. We meant it with Crimea in 2014 with regard to Ukraine and NATO. And so I think the U.S. is in a position to have to give some reassurances somehow or clarify what the position on NATO and Ukraine is going to be, or at least clarify privately to Putin that that Ukraine will not be joining NATO.
Talking to Yoshiko Herrera from UW-Madison, a political science professor there, former director of the Center for Russia, East Europe, and Central Asia, talking about Russia, the U.S., and Ukraine. You can join in at 800-642-1234. In a press briefing after this morning's call, President Biden's National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan was asked about the possibility of U.S. troops responding to a potential Russian invasion of Ukraine. Here's his response.
The presence of American military service members in rotational fashion in these countries is not something new. The question here is not that about whether or not the United States is going to send American service members to the territory of our NATO allies. We do that as a matter of course. The question is, what additional capabilities can we provide to ensure that they feel strong and confident in their own sovereignty and territorial integrity?
Now, Sullivan, they're referring to countries that are part of NATO, unlike Ukraine, including a few former Soviet territories, Latvia, Lithuania, Estonia. Can you talk about the U.S. military role and the NATO role in those Eastern European countries that are kind of bordering on this dispute?
Yeah, well, we have a military alliance with NATO. I think people should keep in mind that the greatest threat to NATO actually came under the Trump administration with his reluctance to have a firm commitment by the United States to NATO. That's something that Putin in his wildest dreams could not have imagined would happen. But with the Biden administration and the renewed recommitment of the United States to NATO, to some extent, the U.S.-NATO relationship is stronger. And the National Security Advisor is correct that, of course, U.S. troops are part of NATO and they are in NATO countries, and you know, we have an alliance and we have a commitment to defend NATO countries against invasions or other kinds of military threats. But Ukraine is not part of NATO, and that that's important because it would not trigger a NATO response necessarily if Russia were to invade NATO, unlike if Russia were to invade Estonia, et cetera, another NATO country. So it's true we have troops there and NATO's allowed to do what it wants, but this is a matter of what does the U.S. want, what does Russia want, what does Ukraine want, and everybody wants an end to the war in eastern Ukraine. It's a stalemate war. It's not serving anybody's purpose. It's unpopular in both Russia and Ukraine. Not a huge number, but a few people are being killed each month needlessly. So it's in everybody's interest to end that war. It's not in anybody's interest to have a war between NATO and Russia. So I think the action needs to be oriented towards de-escalating the possibility of further warfare and ending that conflict.
We're talking today about U.S.-Russia relations with Yoshiko Herrera, political science professor, expert on Russian politics at UW-Madison, and you can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have questions about what's going on here, the Russia-Ukraine conflict? Do you want to see the United States take a strong role here or step back? What do you want to see from President Biden on all this? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our conversation on Russia, Ukraine, and the United States after a meeting between President Biden and President Putin of Russia earlier today. Yoshiko Herrera is with us, political science professor and former director of the Center for Russia, East Europe, and Central Asia at UW-Madison. You could join in if you'd like with your questions, your thoughts on what's going on at 800-642-1234. Yoshiko, a lot of talk today going into this meeting. We don't know exactly what happened in the meeting, about the potential for economic pressure from the United States in response to a potential Russian invasion of Ukraine. I know we had sanctions over the invasion of Crimea, targeting Russia and prominent individuals. Same with Russian election interference in the U.S., some more sanctions. Do we have more economic tools to put pressure on Russia in our toolkit?
Well, we do, theoretically, but the problem is the sanctions have not been very effective thus far. And the danger with sanctions is that it hurts not the It doesn't affect Putin's behavior, which is what we're trying to do, but instead just causes economic harm to the country overall. And in some ways, they can be counterproductive. For example, limiting travel or visas or things like that actually reduces the possibility for person-to-person, business-to-business, student-to-student contact between the countries. So in some ways, trying to come to understanding with the country requires some kinds of economic or social ties, and sanctions directly reduce those. There are more economic sanctions that could be put in place. But what Putin said in 2014 with his actions in Crimea, or that is his actions spoke instead of words, is that he's putting politics over the economy. He's willing to take the economic harm caused by the sanctions for his political goals. And I think we have to keep that in mind, that he's not moved by a slight dip in GDP. He has other political goals in mind. And so I don't think it's likely the sanctions would be very effective in changing his behavior. And I think everybody knows that. I think he knows that. I think that's just known in foreign policy circles that that's unlikely to change his behavior.
You mentioned that the conflict in Ukraine, unpopular, including with Russians. If Russia were feeling the pinch from, say, more economic sanctions, that might sway popular opinion more against Putin. But would that matter? Is there enough of a way to express popular opinion in Russia to force Vladimir Putin to change policy?
Well, Putin is not. His popularity is declining, and his legitimacy is extremely weak. That is, the idea that he has the right to rule, it's very weak. He's relying increasingly on violence to stay in power, and his regime is aware of that. They know they're in a precarious position. They're not as wildly popular as they were in the early 2000s. So he knows he's unpopular. he got a boost in popularity from Crimea, but that went away. And the issue with the sanctions is that the economic harm it causes, the key thing is the blame. Who is to blame? With the Crimea sanctions, the first thing Putin did was slap his own sanctions on preventing importation of some European foods. And he caused harm to his own population, but was able to claim that it was all a result of the Western sanctions. So to the extent he can deflect economic problems by being caused by Western sanctions, he actually gets off the hook for a poor economic situation. So that's the issue with the public opinion, is who is blamed with the economic harm that's caused. And I think so far he's been able to deflect blame to the West and say that it's because of the sanctions that the economy has been doing poorly. But of course, post-2014, the main reason for the economic downturn was the fall in oil prices, but oil prices are up a bit since then, though not as at their high. So that the issue of how you can deflect or move around the blame for economic problems is the key. And I'm not sure that a second round of sanctions is going to be blamed on Putin versus, again, blamed on the West.
Let's bring on a caller. Ron is with us in Oak Creek. Ron, hi.
Yeah, how are you doing? I've been kind of following this, and like I said earlier, I was talking about it. I think we should just totally mind our own business. We've got plenty to do here at home. Putting sanctions on Russia. And, you know, as far as Vladimir Putin is concerned, the people love that guy. You know, I mean, it's just, you know, what we do isn't going to make a hill of beans. We just need to focus on the things that we've got going here and keep our nose out of that type of stuff.
Ron, thanks for the call. Yoshiko, keep the U.S. Out of it and keep it at arm's length, he says.
Well, I think there's probably a lot of Americans that share that view, and I think there's a certain amount of it makes sense in a lot of ways. There's a lot of things to be done in America. But on the other hand, I think our options in dealing with Russia and Ukraine are not just to start another war or only sanctions. I think that we have a lot of diplomatic options. And one possible glimmer of – so I guess I would say, you know, in direct response to the caller, while I appreciate the position, I think there are things the United States could do that would still allow us to keep the focus on, you know, improving America at home, but also to do some good in the world. And the diplomatic options, there may be, you know, a little bit of a silver lining here in that it's possible that Putin wants the United States to get more involved in ending the conflict in eastern Ukraine, because right now the framework for Minsk II was between Ukraine, Russia, Germany, and France, and the U.S. was not part of that. So it's possible that the U.S. could get more involved in enforcing the Minsk agreement and ending the conflict. It's possible that the U.S. could offer some reassurance about not having Ukraine join NATO formally and de-escalate the sense of threat by Russia. And really, the U.S. is the only country that can do that, because whether Ukraine joins NATO or not is not going to be without U.S. support. So I think there are some ways diplomatically that the U.S. might be able to get involved to diffuse the situation. So I guess I that's where I think we should explore those fully, but not just kind of in a knee-jerk reaction immediately go towards escalating towards a war and arming Ukraine.
Ron, thanks for that call. And Yoshiko, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Yoshiko Herrera is a political science professor and former director of the Center for Russia, East Europe, and Central Asia at UW-Madison. She joined us today with the latest from talks between President Biden and Russian President Vladimir Putin over relations with Ukraine. Homelessness across Wisconsin has increased during the pandemic. Officials say unsheltered homelessness has become the main challenge, And with winter coming, cities are racing to find solutions. Diane Bazooka reports on what Madison is doing to get people sheltered.
In a typical year, Ben Jackson says he might connect with 230 unsheltered people in Madison.
The reason they enclose their stuff like this is to try and protect their stuff from being stolen.
He does outreach for a homelessness nonprofit called Porchlight. But last year, that number soared to about 600.
As the pandemic started pushing people out of their jobs, suddenly you had people that had never camped outside, just basically out on the street and, you know, really kind of lost.
Many of those people ended up in city parks. In Madison's Rheindahl Park, an encampment formed that had nearly 100 residents this summer. In response to drug use, crime, and community complaints, the city turned to an industrial site on Madison's southeast side as an alternative. There, on a two-acre lot, they've built what looks like a tiny subdivision of ice fishing shanties.
One of the reasons that Rheindahl Park has proven to be so problematic is because there was very little structure around the use of that park.
Jim O'Keefe is Madison's community development director.
So what we're trying to do out at Dairy Drive is to provide a setting that is everything that Rheindahl Park was not.
For 2 years, Dairy Drive will have around-the-clock staffing and on-site services. But there's only room for 30 people, and many of Rheindahl Park's residents don't want to go. Jamie Goodyear moved to the park with her boyfriend in August when they used the last of their savings to buy a tent.
I don't want to live somewhere where it's literally tinier than the tent we already have. Nope, I don't want to.
Her boyfriend, Anthony Cudingo, recently got a job near Rheindahl Park. Like many residents, he's concerned about the remote location of the new encampment.
Dairy Drive is too far away. They don't have any transportation lined up to help us. We don't have no services out there. There's not a food truck out there. There's just nothing out there at Dairy Drive for us.
Instead, Jamie and Anthony are moving into a hotel near Rheindahl Park. The city is using COVID funding to pay for 35 hotel rooms through June. In fact, federal COVID funds have allowed providers to try new things throughout the pandemic. They've rented hotel rooms for families and vulnerable individuals, opened new emergency shelters, and provided rent assistance to prevent homelessness. Joe Volk, executive director of the Wisconsin Coalition Against Homelessness, says it offered a glimpse of what is possible.
It was kind of like almost a golden era of stuff that we always knew needed to happen, resources that we knew needed to be there, but never had the funding to be able to put those into place.
Pandemic innovations were effective. At the start of this year, Milwaukee had a record low number of unsheltered people. But Volk says once people were in shelters or treatment programs, the next link in the chain was still missing.
Even with the resources to move people into housing, there's no housing to be had. There's literally, physically, not enough low-income housing in the state to house all the people that need housing.
Wisconsin has one of the lowest housing vacancy rates in the nation. And when new affordable housing is built, it's usually priced for households earning around $40,000. But there are few options for the lowest earners. And Volk says this creates a pipeline to the shelter system.
You can have services forever and short-term housing, such as shelters or motels forever, but ultimately you've got to move people into housing that they can afford.
There's little indication that the state is willing to invest the resources necessary to meet this need, and federal aid is running out. So temporary solutions like Dairy Drive are likely to remain a big and increasingly expensive part of Wisconsin's response to homelessness. Diane Bazooka, Wisconsin Public Radio.
Coming up tomorrow at 7 on The Morning Show with Kate Archer-Kent, schools around the country are facing a shortage of substitute teachers, and Wisconsin is no exception. It's making it tougher to keep the doors open. Find out what's driving that shortage of subs and what schools are doing to try to bring in some backup. Plus, they'll want to hear from you. Are you or have you been a substitute teacher yourself? Are you a full-time teacher? Is it tough to get coverage for your classroom? Or do you work as a school administrator? Have you had a hard time finding subs? Have you had to get creative? Are there changes you'd like to see that could make things easier? You can start sharing your experiences right now. Email ideas@WPR.org. That's ideas@WPR.org. Or share your thoughts and your experiences over on the Ideas Network Facebook page. It's the substitute teacher shortage coming up tomorrow morning at 7 here on the Ideas Network. Yesterday, we invited you to call in with the names of your pets and how you came up with them. We heard from a lot of you on the air. Here's some more from email and Facebook. Lynn in Waukesha says, our orange tabby Butters formerly is Butterscotch. Other kitten we had was named Poppy, short for Popsicle. Found Poppy outside half frozen, hence the name. Sue says, so I grew up in the 1950s and the classic dog name was Rover. I've never had a dog and never knew anyone with a dog named Rover. So if I get one, it will be Rover. Jim says Jackson was named at Catkins Animal Rescue, where I adopted him. He and his litter mates were named after presidents and first ladies. Lisa says Sierra chose her own name. I called five different names, and she chose Sierra. Shirley says my husband, a musician, named his dog Tempo. And Danny says Cedar was named after her favorite lake and the six she won't stop munching on. Well, still a lot more to go. Maybe I'll share more tomorrow. This is Central Time. Bow, wow, wow, yippee-yo, yippee-yo, bow, wow.